Okay, good morning. This is Bio 241. It's May 17th, is it? 17th, yes. I can't quite read my watch. It's either the 11th or the 17th, but I guess it's the 17th. Unreal. Okay, so that means that this is the last class. And we're going to go over the last part of renal physiology. And then your final is on May 26th. That's a Wednesday on my schedule right here. Oh, that's right, Thursday, sorry. Thursday, indeed it's a Thursday. All right, exam 5 from 11:30 to 1:30. So that's kind of a strange time because most finals start at 10:30, but I have the room scheduled at 11:30 for us in case you work in the mornings or something. All right, and the chapters that are on the test are 14, 16, and 17. So even if I don't finish today, that whole chapter is going to be on the test. But maybe if I talk really fast, we can get through the whole chapter. But we have an announcement about SI first.
Hi, everybody. We're not going to have an SI session today, but if you guys would like to pre-test, you have my email. You can email me. So, yeah.
Okay, thank you, Crystal. And then there are a couple of announcements for physics class 201/210. If you want to pick those up if you need a physics class for whatever reason. And it's being instructed by Dr. Brenda. That's nice. So here, I'll put those up over here, and maybe I need to turn some of these lights down, like that one right there. All right, anybody have any questions? No? Don't forget, if you want to go back and listen to a lecture, some people listen to lectures, but it's not everybody's cup of tea. If you want to go back and listen to a lecture that didn't get recorded because I ran out of batteries or whatever, you can always go to the previous semester, like fall 2010, and the lectures are pretty similar, all right? So you can always listen to lectures there. All right, so we were talking about autoregulation of the kidney. Autoregulation of what? What is it autoregulating? Okay. It's regulating like urine production, right? Or a better way to think about that is glomerular filtration rate. All right, so the kidney does its job by adjusting the glomerular filtration rate. And by the way, where does glomerular filtration take place? It's in the nephron. What part of the nephron? Yeah, the proximal part, right? Glomerular filtration, but in particular the renal corpuscle, right? That's Bowman's capsule with the glomerulus inside, and that glomerulus is a capillary, so it is specialized for exchange. And what kind of capillary is the glomerulus? It's a special kind, and you should know three different kinds of capillaries. It's fenestrated, which is the middle kind as far as ranking in terms of leakiness. So it has holes in it so that many substances, many small molecules can leak out. Okay, and if it stays in the filtrate, then it gets passed in urine and it becomes part of glomerular filtration. All right, so autoregulation of glomerular filtration. Remember there were two main categories. And autoregulation is which one of these categories? What were the two main categories of regulating glomerular filtration? Extrinsic and intrinsic, and autoregulation is which one of those? Intrinsic, right? It's just a natural property of the way that the nephron is pieced together by its particular properties. All right, and I think we just got done talking about the myogenic response. All right, so as blood pressure goes up, it's going to stretch the walls of the afferent arteriole. And what happens to the radius of that blood vessel when it gets stretched? Yeah, radius goes up. What happens to flow when radius changes, in particular when the radius increases? It goes up by a big way, right? According to the fourth power rule, due to Poiseuille's equation. So as blood pressure increases, afferent arterial stretches, there's this big rush of blood into the glomerulus, so glomerular filtration rate skyrockets as a result of that. That's not healthy for you or the kidney. So as the afferent arterial stretches, what does it do according to the myogenic response? Those smooth muscles constrict back down even when there's an increase in blood pressure to maintain blood flow through the glomerulus at a constant rate, so GFR stays constant. All right, so here is another example of intrinsic regulation, and that is tubuloglomerular feedback. And it's due to the juxtaglomerular apparatus, which is right They're at the, what sometimes we call it, the arterial pole of the Bowman's capsule. That's right where the distal convoluted tubule passes between the afferent and efferent arteriole. And increased flow of filtrate is sensed by the macula densa. These are cells of the distal convoluted tubule, right? And this signals the afferent arterioles to constrict, right? But so when there's an increase of flow past the macula densa, that means what? There is too much blood flow through the glomerulus. The glomerular filtration rate is too high. So the macula densa signals the afferent arterioles to constrict, thereby bringing glomerular filtration back down to the normal rate. Okay, so that's tubuloglomerular feedback. It has to do with flow of filtrate through the distal convoluted tubule, and that adjusts the afferent arteriole radius. All right, so let's move on to another topic, reabsorption of salt and water. All right, the proximal convoluted tubule returns most molecules and water from filtrate back to the peritubular capillaries. So remember, about 180 liters a day of ultrafiltrate are produced, right, which is what, about 45 gallons. So you dehydrate in just a number of minutes, just a few minutes, if it weren't for reabsorption of water. And that's going to be in the proximal tubule. Proximal convoluted tubule, so that only about 1 to 2 liters of urine are excreted in a 24-hour period. So that's a huge rate of reabsorption in the proximal tubule, right? And urine concentration and urine volume varies according to the needs of your body. So if you're drinking a lot of water, you can afford to excrete more. If you're not well hydrated, then the kidney will adjust its rate so that you retain water. And even when you're not drinking water, the kidneys still have to be producing, right, or they're going to die. So there's a minimum 400 milliliters per day urine production that's necessary to excrete metabolic waste in your body. That's how much you have to excrete in order to maintain homeostasis. And so we call that the obligatory water loss produced by the kidneys. Okay, so here we have the renal corpuscle. Here is the afferent arteriole, bringing in large molecules that we see with these, what color are these big molecules right here? Green, and then we got small molecules blue. Notice that the green molecules stay in the blood, but small molecules can leak out through these fenestrated capillaries. So this process right here is called filtration. And let's just say that these are water molecules and salt and things of that nature. And water then gets reabsorbed by the peritubular capillaries. But interesting thing about water, even though it's resorbed, it doesn't get transported. It just moves by osmosis. What moves from the proximal convoluted tubule into the peritubular capillaries are solutes, like, for instance, potassium and sodium. And as we have an increased concentration of potassium and sodium on the outside of the proximal convoluted tubule, guess what happens to water? It likes to move down its concentration gradient, going from a high concentration in the filtrate, okay, to low concentration in this extracellular fluid. So water is never actively transported. It just moves down its concentration gradient. But the solutes are actively transported across the membrane. So here's a pretty good exam figure that shows that. All right, so what are we looking at this figure right here? Well, here's a peritubular capillary, and let's just say this is around the proximal tubule of some kind, maybe proximal convoluted tubule. So here is the wall of the tubule, and you've looked at these, even in anatomy underneath the microscope, you've seen a ring of cells. This is a typical teaching slide that we show of a simple cuboidal epithelium. All right, so here is the wall of that proximal tubule. Here's the peritubular capillary, little interstitial space between them. And then this is inside the tubule. This is the lumen of that kidney tubule, which has, what's in this lumen of this kidney tubule right here? If this is a proximal convoluted tubule, for instance. What's this fluid called? It's called filtrate. Yeah, so here's filtrate. All right, so don't forget, we need to resorb a lot of water and solutes. All right, so here we have a co-transporter. And this is a co-transporter that is going to take glucose from the filtrate and put it inside this tubule cell. Because how much glucose should be lost in the urine? None, right? It should be totally resorbed. All right, so here we have, and where is sodium at a high concentration? Outside the cell or inside the cell? It's outside the cell, so here we have sodium on the outside. Does it want to move inside the cell? Sure, it wants to move down its concentration gradient. Usually it can't because there's no way through the membrane, but if there's this transporter here, as soon as glucose binds to it and a sodium can rush inside the cell as well as glucose. All right, but now, so this is what on the apical surface, so this is the lumen of that tubule, and then on the basal surface or basolateral surface of this kidney tubule, here we have the typical what? Sodium potassium ATP pump. And what does it do? Which way is it pumping? It's pumping because it's moving molecules against their concentration gradient. All right, so it's taking sodium from inside the cell, which is low, and it's pumping it outside, which is high. That requires ATP. All right, so this sodium moves right through the cell. It's resorbed, and then it enters this blood vessel. Right, because it's high outside and it's low concentration inside the blood, so it just diffuses right into the blood. And what is the other thing that's happening here with this primary active transporter right here? It's pumping potassium to the inside of the cell. Right, so this is just a typical sodium potassium ATP pump. All right, so this is bringing glucose inside the cell, right, because sodium is maintained low concentration inside, so glucose keeps working into this kidney tubule right here, the cell. And so now you have a high concentration of glucose in the cell and low in the blood. Which way does glucose want to go? From high concentration to low, it wants to go from the cell into the blood, but it can't get through these membranes, right? But on the basolateral membrane, here is a transporter that allows glucose to pass through the membrane, like a GLUT4 type of transporter, right? So this is what we call facilitated diffusion. So glucose goes from high to low, and therefore glucose moves all the way from the filtrate into the blood as a result of that. All right, so there are a couple active transporters, well, one active transport, and a couple passive transporters right here. Okay, so this is, don't forget, why do we say this is co-transport? What kind of transport is co-transport? Is it primary or secondary? It's secondary. And how do you know this is secondary? Okay, how would you know just by looking at something if it's primary or secondary active transport? Because if it's primary, what has to be drawn here? ATP. It has to be coupled with ATP hydrolysis, and it's not. Therefore, this is secondary active transport as opposed to this mechanism here, which is primary active transport. Okay, so salt and water reabsorption in the proximal tubule. All right, we see filtration happens here, then the proximal tubule is here. Sodium is actively transported, as we saw in the previous slide, and as sodium concentration increases, that draws water out of the proximal tubule by osmosis. So is that passive or active? Osmosis, yeah. So water reabsorption is just a passive process, but realize that it's driven by the active transport of sodium at the proximal convoluted tubule. All right, so 65% of sodium as well as chloride and water is reabsorbed in the proximal tubule, returned to the bloodstream. Right? An additional 20% is resorbed in the descending loop of Henle. Right? So about 85% of the filtered water and salt are resorbed early in the nephron. And this is a constant process, and it's independent of hydration levels. So it's working at 100% of its efficiency all the time. And so that costs a lot of energy, about 6% of your basal metabolic rate, just to resorb water and salt in the kidney. Because remember, how much fluid is filtered by the kidney? 180 liters, 45 gallons a day. All right, the remaining 15% is resorbed variably depending on hydration levels in your body and salt concentrations in your body in the distal parts of the nephron, like the distal convoluted tubule and even the initial segments of the collecting duct as well. All right, so that leads us to collecting duct. That plays an important role in water conservation, how water is managed in your body. Typically, it's impermeable to salt in the medulla. The permeability to water depends on the levels of this hormone right here, antidiuretic hormone. So let's take a look at a scheme that talks about antidiuretic hormone. All right, so when you're dehydrated, right, you have low water intake, that means your body, your plasma becomes what? More salty or less salty? more salty, that means that the plasma osmolality increases, right? Your blood becomes more salty. There are osmoreceptors in the hypothalamus, which then can release or inhibit the release of antidiuretic hormone. And how does that happen? Where does antidiuretic hormone come from? The posterior pituitary, right? So the nucleus is in the hypothalamus, and then there are the axons of those cell bodies go down to the posterior pituitary, and when an action potential reaches that axon terminus in the posterior pituitary, it releases something that looks like what? A neural hormone, antidiuretic hormone. It's released from those synaptic vesicles, and it's picked up by capillaries in the posterior pituitary. And then where does antidiuretic hormone go? All over the body, right? And it's not going to have an effect all over the body, because what does an organ have to have in order to sense changes in antidiuretic hormone concentrations in the blood? It's got to have receptors, that's right. And the organ that has receptors for ADH are the kidneys. So when ADH binds to these receptors, it increases water resorption. All right, so what does water resorption mean? Can you picture which way that water is moving? From where to where? Water reabsorption means from the filtrate going back into the blood. Okay, so less water is excreted in urine when that happens. Right, so it's truly a nice antidiuretic. And so as more water is retained in the body, how does this correspond to what the initial stimulus was? It subtracts from it, so that's a nice negative feedback mechanism. If, on the other hand, if you're overhydrated, then your blood becomes more watery or less salty, so the osmolality decreases, and the hypothalamus can sense that, and it's going to cause a decreased secretion of ADH. And as a result, water resorption will decrease. You'll lose more water in the urine, right? And again, that still is a nice negative feedback mechanism maintaining the hydration levels of plasma in the proper way. Okay, so the capillaries here in the loop of Henle, okay, that resorb this water are what we call the vasorecta. And these are due pretty much to what? The juxtamedullary nephrons. Right, so ADH is working mostly on the juxtamedullary nephron. So here is a really important exam figure. So what do we have on this slide? Nicely color-coded for you. Not so in the study guide. But here is the kidney tubule right here. All right, so this kind of looks like yellow to me. That's a nice apropos color because this is signaling what? Signifying filtrate. This is the fluid that's going to become urine eventually. Right here is the wall of the kidney tubule. And again, you can see it's just a nice simple cuboidal epithelium. Then here's an interstitial space. And then here is that capillary surrounding these tubes right here. All right, so do you see these compartments? The filtrate, interstitial fluid, here is blood, and then here is the wall of the kidney tubule. So inside the blood, we have vasopressin. What's another name for vasopressin? It's a signaling compound. It's a hormone from the posterior pituitary. Oh, I think that maybe was even on the last exam. Vasopressin is another name for antidiuretic hormone. Sure, and people use these terms interchangeably, so you just got to try to remember that. So vasopressin, all right, we see is just dissolved in the plasma right here, so this is a nice hydrophilic hormone, doesn't need to have a carrier protein with it. So since it's a signaling compound, it's got to bind to receptors. Since it's hydrophilic, where are these receptors going to be located? Where are receptors located for hydrophilic hormones? Right on the cell surface, right on the cell membrane. Okay, so who's got that thing playing up there? Okay, even if it's me, I probably would wish if you were to turn it off. Okay, thank you. Okay, so vasopressin is hydrophilic. It's going to bind to a cell surface receptor. Why is that? Why can't there be cytoplasmic receptors for vasopressin? Because it can't get through the cell membrane, right? Because that's a hydrophobic barrier right there. So here is a cell membrane. And so vasopressin is the first messenger, and the second messenger is cyclic AMP. You've studied this scheme before, like through a G protein couple type receptor. So that increases the concentration of a second messenger, which then causes these endosomes, which have aquaporin proteins embedded in the membrane, it causes these endosomes to be routed over to the cell membrane. And it, remember, it just kind of fuses together like a couple soap bubbles bumping into each other. So that inserts the aquaporin membrane proteins into what? The apical membrane right here. And these are water pores. These are water channels. So that allows water, if it wants to move across the cell membrane. Otherwise, it can't do that. Well, let's look at the concentration of water. Here we have the filtrate at 300 milliosmolar. The cell is at 600 milliosmolar, which is what? The concentration of salt. It's not the concentration of water, but it's salt. So where is the water concentration the highest? Outside, in the filtrate. So water will just move in by, you know, I guess we'd have to call that osmosis, right? That's just a special case of diffusion inside the cell. All right, and this interstitial space is 600 milliosmolar, but look at the concentration, the salt concentration in this capillary here. It's high. It's 700. So which way is water going to go from the cell or this interstitial space compared to the vasorecta capillary? It's going to move back in. So what do we call that process of water moving from the filtrate back into the blood? That is reabsorption. Okay, due to what? This signaling compound, antidiuretic hormone, causing the insertion of these aquaporins into the distal tubules, right? Maybe even the collecting duct is the best way to think about that. So the proximal tubule doesn't have this regulation, but the distal tubules in the nephron do, right? So you can resorb more water if there is an antidiuretic hormone signal. And does that make sense? Does that look like antidiuretic hormone? Yeah, because it's producing a lower volume of urine when it binds to this receptor, right? It has an antidiuretic effect. It's taking water out of the filtrate and putting it back into the blood. Okay, so that's for antidiuretic hormone. Renal plasma clearance, all right? So don't forget, secretion is the opposite of resorption. Resorption is taking materials from the filtrate, putting it back in the blood. Secretion is, which way is a molecule going to move? From the blood to the filtrate, right? That is secretion. So it's the active transport of substances from the peritubular capillaries into the tubular fluid or the nephron fluid, which is what we call filtrate. Okay, so it's opposite in direction. All right, so reabsorption decreases renal clearance, but secretion is the opposite that increases renal clearance. Right, so here, let's just pretend this is at the end of a collecting duct. This is the fluid that's going to be excreted. So what produces materials for excretion? It is, the first process is filtration. The second process is secretion. And inhibiting that is what? Reabsorption. So we could write a nice algebraic equation to talk about glomerular filtration, okay, or renal clearance is equal to what? The filtration rate plus the secretion rate, that's putting substances into the filtrate, minus the process that takes stuff out of the filtrate, which is reabsorption. So that's a really nice, simple kind of equation right there. All right, not all of the blood delivered to the glomerulus is filtered into the glomerular capsule. Only 20% is filtered, right? So 80% goes out the efferent arteriole back into the peritubular capillaries and back to your circulation, all right? But substances that aren't filtered still can be cleared by active transport, which we call tubular secretion, into the tubules, all right? So that's a pretty important process. Let's talk about glucose and amino acid resorption, all right? Filtered glucose, all right? What about filtered glucose? What should happen to it? If it's filtered, where is it? It's in the filtrate, and then where is it going to end up if nothing else happens? In urine, right, which is a big waste of energy. All right, so normally, under normal conditions, 100% is reabsorbed from the filtrate in the proximal tubule, right, by what we looked at already, that carrier-mediated transport with what? Sodium, that was that first diagram, right, it's secondary active transport. But since it's a transporter, it can become saturated. If the transporter is all filled with sodium and glucose, then even though there's more glucose in the filtrate, that transporter can't carry any more glucose back into the blood, right? That is what saturation is. All right, the level needed to saturate the carriers and achieve maximum transport is called the transport maximum, that's abbreviated TM. Okay, and that happens to amino acids as well. So glucose and amino acid transporters don't saturate under normal conditions because under normal conditions, glucose is regulated in your blood. How's glucose regulated in your blood? How's glucose concentration decreased? Insulin, and how is it increased? With glucagon, right? So under normal conditions, right, these transporters are never saturated because of insulin. All right, so, but if there is presence of glucose in the urine, we call that glycosuria. All right, that occurs when this threshold is exceeded, 180 to 200 milligrams per 100 mLs of plasma. We call that the renal threshold. That will saturate all the transporters for reabsorption, which then glucose then, some glucose stays in the filtrate. All right, so glucose is normally absent because plasma levels, because of insulin, stay below this level right here. All right, but if there is hyperglycemia, okay, then you get into a condition we call diabetes mellitus. That means all these transporters are saturated. And then, since all the transporters are saturated, what condition does that produce? Hyperglycemia produces glycosuria because all the transporters are saturated and glucose is lost in the urine as a result of that. Okay. All right, so not only glucose, but electrolyte balance is controlled by the kidney. All right, so the kidneys regulate the levels of all of these ions right here, sodium, potassium, even acids, right, hydrogen ion, bicarbonate, and phosphate by matching excretion to ingestion. And so let's take a look at some of these things. And of course, you know the importance of sodium and potassium. Sodium and potassium balance is maintained by aldosterone. So let's think of the nephron in terms of sodium and potassium. 90% of the filtered sodium and potassium are resorbed, all right, before the distal tubule, right, because of co-transport and the active transport on the basal lateral membrane. Right, the remaining 10% is variably resorbed in the distal tubule and even the collecting duct, right, according to the body's needs, and that is adjusted by levels of aldosterone in your body. Right, and you're familiar with the aldosterone mechanism. Okay, it's actually what the renin-angiotensin aldosterone mechanism that you had to draw out, or at least label on the last exam. Okay, and the aldosterone. Notice what the effects of aldosterone are on potassium and sodium. Does it produce the same effects on potassium or sodium or opposite effects? That's something important to look at. And you can see it on this with this statement right here. Aldosterone controls potassium secretion, which is what? Is it you're losing it or retaining it in your body? It is lost, right? So aldosterone promotes potassium loss, but sodium retention, okay? So it's an opposite effect. So that's going to be really important. That could be a really handy key for you to know. Even if you forget which way sodium and potassium go, you should always remember that aldosterone has what? The same effect on potassium and sodium or an opposite effect? Opposite effect. Right? And so on a board exam, for instance, that would be your correct answer, even if you forget which way it goes. All right? All right, so in the absence of aldosterone, 80% of the remaining sodium is resorbed in the distal convoluted tubule and collecting duct. When aldosterone is high, all the remaining sodium is resorbed. So aldosterone promotes sodium resorption in the tubule. All right, so here we have the filtration taking place. Under normal conditions, all the potassium is resorbed in the proximal tubule. So there's no potassium in the filtrate in the loop of Henle right here. But if your body has too much potassium, okay, then it is secreted in the distal convoluted tubule. Okay? And it is secreted under what kind of conditions? When aldosterone is being released. So aldosterone stimulates potassium secretion. So when you have too much potassium, aldosterone causes the potassium to be lost in the urine by secretion process, not through this filtration process right here. Okay, so here is an important control element of the nephron. It's the juxtaglomerular apparatus. So here you see Bowman's capsule, glomerulus right in there, proximal convoluted tubule loop of Henle, and then what is this segment right here called? Distal convoluted tubule. And notice that the distal convoluted tubule passes right between the afferent arteriole and efferent arteriole, and these are in communication with each other. So let's zoom into this region. So this whole area right here is called the juxtaglomerular apparatus. There are macula densa cells that can sense the amount of flow of filtrate moving through the distal convoluted tubule right here. So if the rate is very high, that signals what? That glomerular filtration is too high. Right? And if the rate is really low, that signifies that the glomerular filtration rate is too low. So just by the passage of filtrate past these macula densa cells is a way to adjust glomerular filtration, right? And that's what we call what? Tubuloglomerular regulation. That's just an intrinsic mechanism for adjusting glomerular filtration rate. The other cells right here we see look very granular. They have a bunch of vesicles inside of them. These are called granular cells. Some textbooks actually call these JG cells. They go by maybe different names. And these are actually modified smooth muscles. The macula densa can cause these smooth muscles right here to constrict, thereby what? Decreasing flow through the glomerulus and decrease the glomerular filtration rate. So that's one way that these cells operate. These vesicles right here are filled with a compound called renin. Sometimes it's pronounced renin, but it's spelled with just one E, okay, which is an enzyme, and I think you had to know something about renin. Okay, because renin is an enzyme that works on a compound that's in the blood, which is angiotensinogen. What does renin do to angiotensinogen? It converts it into angiotensin 1. It's on this slide right here, right? So renin from those granular cells, right, within the afferent arteriole, because they're really modified smooth muscle cells, causes angiotensin 1 to be produced. Right, and then angiotensin 1 gets converted into angiotensin 2 by ACE, right, in the lungs primarily, but I think the kidneys even have some ACE in them as well, and maybe some in the liver. And then angiotensin 2, there are angiotensin 2 receptors, right, and cause the release of aldosterone. So what organ has angiotensin 2 receptors that can release aldosterone? Where's aldosterone coming from? What organ? That's from the adrenal gland. What part of the adrenal gland? The cortex, because remember the medulla releases epinephrine and norepinephrine. Okay, so aldosterone from the adrenal cortex. Okay, inadequate intake of sodium chloride always causes a decrease in blood volume. Okay, because that lower osmolality inhibits ADH secretion, causes less water reabsorption. Right, and that low blood volume and renal blood flow stimulate release of renin. Right, and so here is, oops, I flipped through the slide right here. Right, and what happens when you have low blood volume? There's low blood pressure. Right, low blood pressure has an effect on the granular cells by causing renin release. And when you have low blood pressure, also sympathetic tone increases because you have low blood pressure via the baroreceptor reflex. And the kidney is innervated by the sympathetic nervous system. So direct effects and also by sympathetic reflex, right, in renin secretion will be increased. So let's take a look at a flow diagram that shows that. So with low sodium intake, what happens to plasma levels of sodium? They decrease, right? The hypothalamus will sense that, and then via the posterior pituitary, it will withdraw the release of antidiuretic hormone. And as antidiuretic hormone decreases, what happens to urine production? As ADH goes away, what happens to urine production? It goes up. So what happens to blood volume? It goes down as a result, right? So as ADH concentration decreases, water reabsorption in the collecting duct decreases because the aquaporins are taken out of the membrane, put back in those endosomes, and that increases urine volume, decreases blood volume. All right, and as your blood volume decreases, what happens to your blood pressure? It decreases, so that stimulates sympathetic nerve activity. Decreased blood volume is sensed by the juxtaglomerular apparatus, so both of these things will increase renin secretion, which eventually, through this mechanism right here, increases aldosterone. Aldosterone then goes to the kidney to increase sodium resorption in the collecting duct. And as sodium is resorbed, it's retained in the blood, and what is this response compared to the initial stimulus? It subtracts from it, so this is a nice negative feedback mechanism that is happening right here. So here is aldosterone causing increased sodium retention, but at the same time, just for fun, what's happening to potassium when there's an increase in aldosterone? Okay? Always say that sodium and potassium are going to be what? The same, they're going to be opposite. So if sodium is being resorbed, what's happening to potassium under this condition? It's going to be secreted, right? Okay, due to this aldosterone. So I think I have another important exam figure right here. All right, this is not in your textbook, but I gave you these keys in your study guides. All right, so we have the same compartments. We have filtrate in the kidney tubule right here, which is yellow. And then we have the simple cuboidal epithelium that makes up the tube of the nephron, and then a little interstitial fluid, and then we have a peritubular capillary right here with blood in it. All right, and in the blood, we have a signaling molecule, aldosterone. Don't forget, where does that come from? Adrenal cortex. And aldosterone is what kind of compound? Is it hydrophilic or hydrophobic? Tell me something about it. It's hydrophobic. Why would you say hydrophobic? Because it's a steroid-based hormone, right? So it's a steroid-type hormone, so there are carriers so that it can dissolve in the blood, all right? And then it will diffuse into this interstitial space just because of a concentration gradient. Now, where is the receptor for aldosterone since it is hydrophobic? Another way of saying is that it's what? Lipophilic. It likes lipid. So what can it do? Since it likes lipid, it can move across the cell membrane right here, right? And so where's the receptor for steroid hormone? Inside the cell. So here's a cytoplasmic receptor. And remember that steroid hormones work by acting as transcription factors. Woo, what does that mean? What is it going to make eventually? It's going to make proteins, right? Because transcription is the first part of protein synthesis. And just for fun, I wish I could give extra credit, but I don't have any buttons on your desk. What's the second part of protein synthesis? If transcription is the first part, what's the second part? Translation. Yeah, really good. Okay. So aldosterone binds to this receptor. It stimulates transcription, makes messenger RNAs, which are going to result in the production of what? Proteins. Right, so translation then happens in the cytoplasm that you learned about. So what are some of these proteins right here? Some of these proteins are inserted into the membrane, the apical surface of the membrane. These are channels, right? And these are going to be channels for both sodium and potassium, okay? And it will make some more proteins that are going to be pumps. Like what's your favorite pump? So yeah, ATP, yeah, a pump has to use ATP, but how about the sodium-potassium pump? And what can you tell me about that sodium-potassium pump? Just a little something about it. It's going to, what molecules is it pumping? Sodium and potassium. And in what direction? Are they going in the same direction or opposite directions? Opposite directions. So which way is it pumping sodium, in or out? Out and potassium in. Okay, now that's really crucial. Maybe I can think of to ask you a nice, insightful question in just a minute about that. Okay, but the third kind of protein that it makes, all right, are molecules that can modulate the activity of existing channels and pumps already. All right, so it can turn on, it can activate a potassium channel, it can activate sodium channels instead of them being blocked. Right, we can see that they are open. All right, so these are regulating proteins that are made by aldosterone right here. All right, so we have sodium that's low inside the cell, and it is high inside the lumen, and if that channel is open, where is sodium going to move? Inside, and it's going to exchange with potassium. All right, so that's going to, potassium will be leaving the cell. So now we have sodium inside the cell, okay, and we have high sodium outside the cell in this interstitial space, how can sodium go from low to high? Some kind of pump. And what do we have right here? Well, the nice typical sodium potassium ATP pump. All right, so that pumps sodium into the interstitial fluid, okay, which then gets picked up in the blood because the concentration of sodium in the blood is less than the interstitial space right here, right, because of the activity of this pump. So what do we see? We see potassium moving from the blood into the filtrate over here, right, due to the sodium potassium pump and these channels. All right, so what process do we call this? Potassium going from blood to filtrate. That is tubular secretion. And we have sodium that moves from the filtrate into the blood. We call that tubular reabsorption. And what hormone produces that? Aldosterone. Okay? And the other thing that you should see is that the sodium-potassium pump is located in where? The apical membrane or this basolateral membrane? The basolateral membrane. And if you just remember that and just remember something about this pump, you can always see that aldosterone causes secretion of potassium but resorption of sodium right there. So what's the basic underlying principle of how aldosterone works? It has an opposite effect on potassium and sodium because it's set up by this thing that you learned about months ago. It's just what? The sodium-potassium ATP pump right here. All right, so it works in conjunction up with the sodium-potassium pump, which does what to sodium and potassium? Moves it in opposite directions, right? So hopefully you didn't forget that. All right, so that's the mechanism of action for aldosterone. Okay, so here's the juxtaglomerular apparatus, and in particular the macula densa cells right here. Here are the granular cells that release renin, okay, and that's right at what we call the arterial pole of the renal corpuscle right here. Right, and it acts as a sensor for tubular glomerular feedback needed for regulation of autoregulation of glomerular filtration. Right, so the macula densa signals the afferent arteriole to constrict, right, when there is high flow of filtrate. Right, and when the afferent arteriole constricts, what happens to glomerular filtration rate? It goes down, and therefore the flow of filtrate past the macula densa will go back to normal. So that's a nice negative feedback mechanism. All right? The granular cells also cause a decrease, depress renin secretion, right, when blood sodium is high. All right, so don't forget where that little signal is coming from, the juxtaglomerular apparatus. All right, and the third hormone that we talked about besides ADH and aldosterone, right, was atrial natriuretic hormone. All right, and where is that produced? In the atria of the heart, when what happens? When the blood volume gets too large, that means that there's too much fluid in the blood, so the atria stretch, that releases atrial natriuretic hormone that causes the secretion of salt, right, and the excretion of water and urine, and so it acts as an endogenous diuretic. What does endogenous mean? It's produced by your body, inside your body. It's not something that you have to take, right? You don't need a shot or a pill to do that. All right, so if it causes salt excretion and water excretion, what's the relationship to ADH and aldosterone? It is antagonistic to it, right? Okay, and so when blood volume increases, that causes increased venous return. It stretches the walls of the atria, and the atria then release atrial natriuretic hormone, or peptide. All right, so atrial, that's pretty easy to understand. Well, what about this word natriuretic? And natrium refers to sodium, right? Like, what's the chemical symbol for sodium? It's Na, that really means natrium, and uretic means what? Is urine, right? So this is a hormone that promotes sodium loss in urine, right? So by knowing the name will help you understand what the action is. All right, and you know what? That is the last slide. right there. So I talk way too fast. Okay, well, so that's it for class today. Now, there are some people that still have to take a couple quizzes today in lab, right? Some people have lab today still? Or is the last lab over with already?
Today.
All right, so I think you get a lab quiz, and then you get an extra credit quiz. You have to draw the ovarian cycle and uterine cycle and some hormone profiles. And it's pretty impressive that you guys are doing well with that. That is really nice. So if you still have to take that quiz, and if you think you have no chance, guess what? You have a chance. You have to do it, because everybody else is doing really good with that. So congratulations. All right, when's the final? So is it a week from today? No, today's a Tuesday. It's a week from Thursday. All right, so you got a lot of time to study. My office hours, they're a different time during finals week. I have them on my door, but I'll post them in Blackboard too. So they're at a different time.